Welcome back to the Amateur Theatre Podcast and episode 18. A really fun one for you today with Wayne T. Brown, who is an actor, director and a writer. And he utilises those three skill sets to offer some really interesting and illuminating ideas and insights as we move through his career. Hopefully a lot of stuff you can take away. And it was really good fun having someone with some slightly different perspectives on the creation of a theatre show. Hopefully I do him justice. So sit back and enjoy.
I started theatre when I was 13. I didn't have a hobby, and a friend of my mum's said, what do you do outside of school? And I said, well, nothing, because I was very shy. And she said, oh, well, what do you like? And I remember, I think when I was about 11, I'd seen a pantomime. And there was a guy in it who was like a year older than me in the school. And he was giving it everything. You know, he was there. He was the comic of the panto. And everybody loved him. And I was like, I want to be him. I want to do that. Or whatever that is. I don't know what that is, but I was doing it. It was basically him just coming on mugging and saying a sort of brief approximation of the lines and going off. And I was like, I want that. So when this lady said to me, what do you do? I said, oh, I want to be in a play. Now, I thought that's what the play was, the panto. Right. So when she came back with a piece of paper and said, oh, call this woman Gwyneth, they've got the junior section of the local amateur theatre. So I did. I found the woman and I went along, and they were doing this. They do actual proper plays and everything with no music. And I was like, okay. So my first play was The Gingerbread Man. Nice. By David Woods, which is brilliant. And I was the Gingerbread Man.
Hey, look at that. Where do you go from there?
Exactly, yeah. Two nights in Workington. Come and see me. And I was 13, but the gingerbread man wasn't actually the lead. It was I think he was a rat or right. A mouse that was trying to get the gingerbread man. Oh, he was the big man. Right. And the fella who played that actually went on to be a professional actor because he was brilliant. David McCready. Hi, David, if you're listening. So I was hooked. That was it. I was in. And I remember the terror on the director's face, Gwyneth. She said, I have no idea what you're going to do when you're faced with this audience, because it's literally your first ever show. And I loved it. And I just went on. And I don't remember any nerves at all.
Really?
Which is really strange. And now it's one of the worst things about performing, I find now.
Really?
The nerves, yeah, it's quite nerve-wracking. And obviously you develop techniques over the years, but I was 13, just went on. And then I did, when I was, I think 16, I did a school panto, like a school production, like everybody, well, a lot of people do. And I was Dracula's assistant. I was basically his straight man to his funny jokes, which weren't very funny. The thing about that was that I was, you know, bullied at school for being, you know, quite camp. And surprise, surprise. And
they didn't knock it out of you then.
They didn't knock it out of me, no. In fact, it got worse. They were telling me things I didn't know, but I found out later about myself. I remember this production, and at the end, because it was Cinderella, but like with Dracula.
Right.
And they had a dance in the middle of it. And the dance was to Thriller. And I did this thing, and I went on with this cape. And like, I don't know what anybody thought they were watching. And I was just flapping this cape and doing the whole thing. And I was miming to the darkness. And people just like sat there with their mouths open going, what is this? And what is he doing? But afterwards, people were really shocked because they didn't think that I could do that. And I didn't think I could do that. And it kind of just came out of nowhere.
Okay.
I was like, okay. And then from there, when I got too old for the junior group, I joined the senior play acting group. And I was in a few things like When We Are Married, and I played Gerald, a 17-year-old Gerald, which is I think he was probably supposed to be about 26 or something. And this woman was in it, and she said, "Oh, I've just got the thing for you. I want you to come over to my company in the next town in Whitehaven, and be in this production of Half Sixpence. We need a photographer." And I was like, "Okay." A pretend photographer, you know, what shouts, "Hold it, you know, one more picture," like this. And what she didn't tell me was that, she was giving me very sort of sketchy direction of what she wanted me to do. And she was going, and I was like, you know, "One more picture, hold it." And then she said, "Can you be a bit more fussy? You know, so fussy." I was like, "Okay." She said, you know, sort of, "Play with the clothing of the women behind you, you know, make them look nice and everything." So I was kind of going, okay. Anyway, eventually, after about like an hour of this, this guy stood up. He was a policeman. And he said, "Wayne, she wants you to camp it up." And I said, "Oh, well, why didn't she say?" So I went on. So basically, I got into musical theatre because I'm camp. Right. So I had this big beret and this big bow, floppy bow. And I said, "One more picture, hold it." So I did all of that. And then for some reason, and then of course, when you've got a small part like that, if you're young, they just have you dancing. So then I kind of had a bit of an aptitude for movement, I would call it, rather than dance. I really enjoyed it. And then from there, I've gone on to, I moved out of Cumbria and I went to Harrogate, and I was in the Harrogate Operatic Players, and they did some fantastic production, because the thing about amateur theatre is that it isn't professional standard, mm-hmm. You know, a lot of them are very, very professional. So these guys did their plays at the Harrogate Theatre, but also the Royal Hall, you know, in Harrogate, mm-hmm. which is like 1100 seater. Do you know what I mean? It's huge. And Oxford Operatic Society, they perform at the New Theatre and the Playhouse, so there's sort of 600 people and, you know, I think it's 1800.
Yeah.
It's massive. And, yeah, so they have to perform to a professional standard because that's what people expect. So that's what I've learned over the years with these fantastic groups that I've been in. And some of them have been smaller, just straight plays. And some of them have been, you know, huge productions. Crazy for You, you know, dancing soldiers with women with feathers and things. And it's just been it's kind of been like an education over a really long period of time. So from, say, 1983, 84, through to, you know, now even. And you still learn as you go along, don't you? You learn definitely. From people who are, a lot of people have got natural talent. And I was with one of the great people you've had on your podcast, Craig Finley, who was fantastic, Craig. Very good. Very good. And one of
those
people...
He was on. He may not listen.
He probably won't, yeah. Probably doesn't care. But, you know, people like that who can literally come in and do one thing and be this sort of foolish part and then come on and be this really serious, you know, within the same sort of half hour. And it's people like that who I admire.
Yeah.
Because then it makes me think, oh, actually, I can do... You know, you can... It just basically allows yourself to get the best performance out of yourself, and when you're director, out of your actors as well, and push them. And, you know, a lot of people need it brought out of them, but that isn't to say what they bring to the stage is valid.
Yeah.
So
I will dig deeper on that. So where do you find yourself now? What's kind of like the center? Because you seem to have, I mean, over that period, you've done plays, you've done musicals. Where do you find your focus is now? What are you up to in terms of like production stuff, or are you still acting? Are you still, you know, or have you focused more on the writing? I know you do a lot of writing and stuff. So where's the kind of the energy being focused on?
Well, so I kind of got more confidence because I was always a chorus person, and I just thought that's what I am. I'm a chorus person, and then somebody pointed out that, you know, I had something to offer, something more to offer, and why don't you audition? Yeah. So I did. And I
was, what age are we talking about? This
conversation? Oh, this is when I was in my 40s.
Oh, really?
So,
oh,
yeah.
Right,
I mean, okay. It took a long time really? For me to have courage.
Okay,
to...
so sorry, I'm an interrupter. I'd interrupt.
No, do.
Okay,
so interrupt me.
What? So just, I just want to just well, again, I think we'll come back to it definitely, but just to set that up, what happened in that period where from 17, 18, when you kind of...
17. Whatever born in 17, 18. Not that old.
When you kind of like, clearly, like if someone's seeing something, you're seeing you do something and saying, come and join us, there's obviously they've spotted something or whatever. But if you're then saying that you fell into the kind of the chorus role in the, you know, the bigger productions or whatever it might be, how is it that you waited till you were 40 to kind of...
It's confidence.
Is it what it was?
Yeah, somebody pointed at me. And I'm going to name her. She's called Nia Williams. And I'm now working with her in a professional capacity. But she pointed at me. She was the repetiteur, the pianist at the for the, you know, the Oxford Operatic Society and many other things that she does professionally. And she just pointed at me and she said, you stop being at the back.
Really?
And I honestly cite...
That's massive.
I cite that moment as being really pivotal in going, well, what do I want to do? Why am I here? You know, and I did enjoy it. I do enjoy being in chorus and you know, and just dancing, you know, and there's lots of big production numbers. And I've had some brilliant parts and they're really, you know, enjoyable. They're usually people who I can play around with, you know.
Yeah.
So, like, for instance, like the partner in Canterbury Tales is, you know, so you can... bring my type of humor,
yeah.
Because humor is very important to me, and that's why I wanted to get into the theater, because this guy was making people laugh.
Yeah.
So really I should have been a comedian, maybe not, but that's what it was the laughter, it was that. And then of course you're in different productions and then there's drama,
yeah,
and you think, oh gosh, and I know what I'm going to do with this.
So
what was your question again?
No. So I think my question was answered, but I will dig deeper in that. We're going to hit that 40 point in a bit and we'll discuss kind of like those, the change in your mindset maybe, or the breakthrough that she allowed you to have. Prior to that then, can we kind of discuss or try and unravel the initial period that you went through as a teenager or whatever it was, and when, I guess I like the idea of discovering when you realized it was serious. Like, so there's kids stuff, and I don't want to sort of demean or diminish that because all that experience and stuff, but at some point you realize that people are watching you and, you know, and it's a serious affair because maybe you're mixing with adults who are taking it more seriously. Do you have a recognition of kind of when you began to take it more seriously and when it became like I'm hoping it was still fun throughout, but kind of from a fun perspective to a more kind of like, oh, I can do this and I want to deliver something. So I'm beginning to think about my character or stuff. Is there like a...
Yeah. I did apply for drama school. I did audition.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't, again, it came down to confidence.
Right.
And I didn't have the confidence and to try again, because obviously, you know, there's a lot of money involved in auditioning. And I know that drama schools now are starting to bring their fees down.
Oh yeah, wait.
But I lived in the northwest, top of England, you know, near Scotland, behind the mountains, and everything took sort of 5 years. Fashion, everything took longer to get there. And I just felt really that I didn't know what to do, and I didn't have the resources to know that, oh, this is what you do, and, you know, and the money,
yeah,
really to travel and to pay to audition.
Well, especially were you considering London, or were you considering what was around you?
Everywhere. So I auditioned at Birmingham, Manchester, Bristol, but I had two goes at it.
Yeah.
But there was a long gap in between. So instead of sort of getting, you know, a rejection, that's fine. We can say that word. It is a valid thing.
I believe all of those people applying to drama school are getting rejected.
Exactly. And, you know, for whatever reason, and it could be nothing to do with your performance. And in fact, I have heard that a lot of drama schools don't like you to be too slick. Really, they like you to be somebody that they can mould,
yeah,
which is a whole other conversation. So I left it a long time, and then I sort of had another go. And I think I was probably about 31, and I went into the to the audition, and one of the, I think it was a panel of seven, it was ridiculous. And one of the guys said, "So why at your great age?" And I was 31, and like, now I'm 52. Off. And I'm like, yeah, well, yeah, fuck you. And I sort of laughed it off and everything. And I did, you know, I did get a couple of callbacks, and, you know, sort of when you make it after lunch and you make it through to the next day and that kind of thing. And I was on a list, apparently, and I wasn't lifted from the list. They sent me a letter. There was no internet in those days. To say I wasn't
pigeon
lifted.
Flew in.
Yeah, they were literally
unravelled.
An owl came in, dropped something through the chimney. So you know, that kind of thing. And I didn't, instead of just carrying on, right, next year and pushing. And the other thing as well, money.
Yeah.
I had a job. I've done lots of jobs over my life. And it's kind of always been, you know, obviously money is very important. And so there's that. Yeah. There's having the time off to go to auditions. And then people just constantly telling you, and it worked on me because they constantly told you it's a very, very difficult, overcrowded profession, la, 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 la. And I kind of let them beat me down. Yeah. And well, obviously I wasn't meant for it because you have to be, as other people have said on your podcast, that you have to be tenacious, ferociously tenacious, really, to get work.
Yeah.
And I probably wasn't that person anyway. So.
What's even weirder, I mean, I think the last point you just made throws me back into kind of wanting to ask you about being kind of up north and having this desire to go on to a drama school course. I know I'm stepping back to what we talked about before, but hopefully it will feed through to the point you just made. What it sounds like, and you please correct me if I'm completely wrong, but a lot of people who are kind of operating in Oxfordshire or London or kind of like, you know, affluent home counties kind of people have a lot of inspiration because they look to their right or their left and there's five other people going, yeah, drama school sounds bloody great. Let's all go to drama school together or whatever. How did you like generate the courage? And I know you said after like two kind of rounds or attempts, they kind of knocked it out of you and you ended up not pursuing it maybe as far as you'd like to have done at that time. But how did you initially kind of get over, because you've mentioned nerves a few times and kind of courage, how for someone who wasn't surrounded by, I'm presuming, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but not surrounded by a lot of artistic people and not surrounded by kind of a lot of drivers to say, yes, pursue that thing that may make you no money at all and cause you pain throughout your life. You know,
you're just talking about anything in my life, basically.
No, but I mean, as you say, again, you mentioned money as well. It seems like, because money is important. Money makes the world go round and it means security and comfort to a certain degree to step out of a place where they maybe not have had, you know, a massive amount of people who were going, me, I want to be an actor. How did you, what was the kind of...
So in going back to my youth theatre, I met a girl, she was then, a couple of years older than me, and she was very enthusiastic, and she was definitely going to uni.
Right.
And I didn't have any ambition to go to, I didn't even think that was a thing, you know. Right. I got like one O-level in English and three CSEs, you know, in biology and history. And so I assumed that I had to work in a factory or in a shop or something. And she took me to see, I mean, amazing that the RSC did this, and I hope they still do, take plays out into the communities. I had Alan Armstrong in The Crucible and A Winter's Tale at my local sports centre in Workington in like 1984 or 1985. And there was straw on the floor. It was in the round. I didn't even know what that meant. And it was just stunning. I could smell it. You were just there in it. And it was just fantastic. And it was my first Shakespeare as well. So what a brilliant Shakespeare to see.
Yeah.
And this woman, Sarah, she She encouraged me and said, you can do it. And she helped me with my, because you had to write a whole great big long dissertation as to why you want to be in right. there. I didn't have those words. So she, you know, she really, really helped me and encouraged me. So again, somebody else poking and prodding and saying, look, you can do this.
Yeah.
And you have to listen to those people because, you know, if you just say, oh, I can't. There's a reason why people keep telling you these things.
Yeah.
So that was it, really. Okay. It was this friend, and she encouraged me and still does, really.
I would like to dig deeper on that because I agree again with what you're saying. And I guess how do you instill that in someone? How are you as a director? I'm going to allow you to put your director hat on now, or even if you as a someone who's done multiple roles, some of bigger, some smaller, how are you instilling that in yourself or in an actor that you're working with?
You have to give them permission.
Okay.
So that is the main thing. For me, I always have to give permission. So I was given permission by Nia to come forward to audition. I was given permission by Sarah to audition for drama skills. You know, I'm just that person, unfortunately. And again, it's really annoying. But as soon as someone tells me you can,
yeah,
I think, oh, I probably can then. So in rehearsals, and it's, you know, even from the outset when you have the talking or, you know, the first read through, you just give people permission right. to play, to experiment, and tell them it's okay. And sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And, you know, honesty, you have to be honest with people and say, that's actually not working for me. And if the actor says, more often than not, the actor will go, I wasn't feeling that either, which yeah. is brilliant, because then you go, good. And that person was thinking, shit, are they going to make me do this the whole way through? And I'm not feeling it at all.
Yeah.
This character is not a lawyer or whatever, you know, kind of kick-ass person. It's a, you know, but you've tried it.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing I can think to say is try things, and they won't always work. And the other thing is, take feedback. Just take it. Say thank you.
Yeah.
You know, take praise. That's a really big thing. If someone tells you you're brilliant and that you've done a really good job and it's amazing, don't say, oh, well, no, because it's the director, you know, shut up. Just say, well, thanks. This project that I'm working on or have been working on, it's finished now, Shakespeare, She, Her. I've realised that, you know, I had 15 women and they were all, you know, amateur performers, but they all had different skill sets. And whereas I might just mention something to one of the actors and say, what about this? Or you find an analogy and say, do you remember that person who we used to know, that thing, or that person off the telly, or that, one of my things is politicians. So in rehearsals, I'll do a lot of things with them, which again was a gift that was given to me when I was rehearsing, or was actually auditioning. And she said, do it like you're five. Okay. And, you know, like, how would a five-year-old say this? And everything is valid. You know, everything that is said, you could say it as a five-year-old, you could say it as a teacher. So again, another really good sort of exercise that I like to do is say it as though you're telling a class of five-year-olds. And it could be Hamlet, it could be, you know, John Godbury, it could be anything. But if you say it, And
are you doing that just to give them a different way?
It's give them a different flavour.
Right.
A different flavour, different colour, whatever. And always there's something comes out of it.
Right.
So they might hate it. They might feel ridiculous. Please, I can't emphasise this enough. Rehearsals are about play. They're about trying everything. It should be a safe space.
Yeah.
People should feel that they can experiment, because where else can you do it other than in a rehearsal?
Definitely.
So I'm a big believer in that. And like I say, one of the exercises I do is to, you know, you're a primary school teacher, talk to them like they're five. And another one is, you know, you're a lawyer. and you're given testimony in a court, and you want to convince the jury that what you're saying is true.
Yeah.
And it could be, you know, it could be any number of things. It could be the Prime Minister, you know, giving a speech and you want to be re-elected, or anything at all. And even if, you know, people do sometimes feel silly and they think, oh God, what has this got to do with being a Prime Minister or whatever? But something will always come out of it, even if it's just a nuance of a line or the type of character.
Yeah.
And some people have gone fully with it and gone, great, no, this character is a kick-ass lawyer. I love it. And they've gone, we've had everything from, you know, someone who's been locked up in a barn to someone who was at a one of the women who's playing Rosalind, one of the speeches in Shakespeare. She's Rosalind in As You Like It, but it's a character who's at a Halloween party and she's dressed like the Invisible Man, so she's literally swathed in bandages and has a hat and a pipe and everything, and he's genius. That was her idea, you know. And there's a line, just because I'm caprissoned like a man, you know, the Invisible Man. And then she says something about, you know, this concealed man. Tell me about this concealed man that she's not telling her about. And she references her face that she's covered in bandages. And it's all of these things. It's like, how on earth do you get through that to that? But it's just been this whole project has been a wonder, really, of all of the different things that you can... all of the different places you can go with characters and who they are. It's just really important to decide who they are as well.
Right.
And people talk about background and everything. And, you know, it is important. I do really think that if you're playing a role, even if it's just you have no lines, who are you? Why are you there? And I know this is a big ask for people, as I say, if they're just coming on and they're just pointing at something and smiling and then having a dance and then they walk off. But you are somebody. I just need to say that recently there was a production of My Fair Lady by Oxford Operatic Society. Mm-hmm. And there were some issues around cast being off for COVID reasons. And one of the actors... He directs and acts, and he came on, he had no lines. I think he had a few lines, but he'd literally come in from cold, from nothing. And he gave it the energy of somebody who'd been rehearsing it for 6 months. He was just, it was amazing in the dance sections, and I completely believed him. If he didn't have any lines, I would have thought he did have lines.
Yeah.
So it's about that. It's, and... yeah, take the praise and take criticism as well, because usually if given the right way, and it should be given the right way, you have to think, okay, so we're all here to do a job to make this the best thing it can possibly be. So if someone tells me, like I've told, you know, some of the women, look, that this isn't working. Why is it not working?
Mm-hmm.
And they might say, oh, well, I thought it was working. And then I can say why it isn't working. So, for instance, it doesn't feel right, or perhaps she should, I don't know, stand and say it. What would that do to your posture, to your sort of characterization, or the way that you say the words? Should you slow down or break it up? And then maybe you just have to go back to the text and say, right, what does this actually mean? And quite often, and especially with Shakespeare, but with any text, they might not really understand what it means and they're just saying the words.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, again, if you're giving them an analogy, well, it's like this. Oh, right, okay. And then they have that idea in their head and it comes out different.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people have said that I've spoken to, like, especially with Shakespeare, if you do find a kind of a modern day translation where you can say, look, have a read of this and you'll understand the flow of it and the ideas that are behind it and where it's come from, that might help you kind of decipher what you're saying.
One of my favourite things to do is say, tell me in modern words, what does it mean? What is she doing? And usually they can say it in one sentence. Well, she's not happy about the fact that he's done that and she wants to get back at him. Brilliant.
There we go.
That all of that, it took four minutes, you know, to perform, but... You know, she's playing it, or she's playing a trick on him, and you know, wants to give him a dose of his own medicine.
Yeah. How much work as a director are you doing in preparation for those moments? Are you do you do you rely on your just your experience and understanding of what is going on to be able to guide or point people in the right direction? Or have you, do you tend to kind of do some work prior to each of, like, the stuff you're working on now, each of those, was it 35 that you did? Are you dissecting those and in preparation to meet that person and then work with them? Or are you allowing yourself to feel it in the moment? What's kind of your approach to dealing with that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I think probably 3/4 of in the moment.
Okay.
And a quarter, you know, yeah, because you do have to do some preparation. You do have to know what you think the speech or the play is about. And you know, a lot of people would be like, oh, you have to know 100% what's going on and you have to know it backwards and inside out. And yes, you know, that's great and you should know it. But especially if it's a quick turnaround as well, which a lot of these pieces were, because I had the people for just a few rehearsals, usually over Zoom. One of the people I met for the first time over Zoom. So, and then we did a rehearsal. So you have to go with you, especially if you don't know the person and what they're like, what their skill set is. But yeah, for me, it's kind of a quarter of, you know, I kind of knew where I thought it might go. And then the person comes in and does this performance or does this, you know, and you go, I did not see that coming. Good. And you have to be willing to change your idea and direction as well.
Yeah.
Because you want the best out of that person. And then, of course, when people get together, so if there's more than one person and they're dynamic, which is why auditions are so important.
Yeah. No, I mean, actors I've spoken to seem to be always like considering what's going on. And as you said, you know, half an hour ago, the idea that an audience is going to be different and give you something different back when you are performing means that you're feeding off a different energy than you were two nights ago, and therefore you're going to try and bring something different. And
they have to, you have to, I think as a director as well, you have to advise them of that or warn them about that, that, you know, look, you know, it's not going to be, you know, it's not a carbon copy every night. You know, you're not just, you know, you might as well send a fax out, you know, just a fax. Where is he living? The 1970s. It is different every night.
Yeah. In terms of your structure of rehearsals, do you have in your head like a process through which you want to get yourself ready for the shows and the cast ready for the shows? Are you kind of structuring the room in a certain way where by this time you'll have done this, or, you know, or are you allowing it to kind of be a little bit more organic in terms of its coming together?
Yeah. I do have a structure, and I want to get this scene done or two scenes done. I think the worst thing you can do is try and get too much done.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you go in and you've got this time pressure on yourself, and sometimes it is a question of time, you only have a certain number of rehearsals, but where possible, you break it up into manageable chunks and you give them time to, again, play around with the text and with the movement. But again, a lot of it is organic. Mm-hmm. It really is. And I do really believe in people bringing, you know, their skills. I do know an actor, won't mention him, and he says to me, oh, just tell me what you want. Show me what you want me to do. I said, no, I'm not doing that. You know, I have an idea. I could go and do it, you know. I think, and that's the other thing as well, you know, you should be able to, I think the director should be able to, in some way, go on and do that part to say, you know, woman, child, man, whatever, because they must have an idea of what the movement is or what the character is. I'm not going to let them get away without doing any work.
No, which I think
they
is,
have to do the work as well.
Yeah, definitely. Especially if the, I mean.
And the thing is, we're talking about play. We're mainly talking about plays, I think, and musicals. But I think we have to give due consideration to the fact that, for instance, like operatic societies or MAC, people who do musicals, they often have a lot of characters, a lot of actors, and you know, people want their moment in the spotlight, but it's not really, you can't really with, you know, sort of 30 people. Yeah. Say, right, what's your character? You have to trust them.
Yeah.
You have to trust them to that they will do the work.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, because I've not ever done musicals. I've never performed or directed. And yeah, I've never considered you are reliant on 25 of the 30 people to have gone home, done some homework and come to the stage with at least a semblance of a character. Otherwise, they will stick out. You'll see that one person who has no idea what's going on, what the show's about.
You know it. There are usually a couple of people, maybe three or four. And, you know, they're just there because they enjoy it. It's their hobby at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You know, people do, I think, do you know what? I think audience do enjoy kind of pointing them out and going, look at her over there with the clipboard. You know, she's just wondering about, isn't she? You know, she doesn't really know. And that's like it's like a sport really, isn't it, I suppose? But the person is obviously loving what they do.
Yeah.
They really enjoy it, you know, and they may never have had a, you know, maybe never have a lead role. Maybe they've never had a line, you know, but they really enjoy it. So at the end of the day, I think we have to remember and not get, you know, too ahead of ourselves with amateur theatre that, you know, it's someone's hobby.
Yeah.
And they pay to do it as well, you know, and some of the, you know, societies, organisations, they aren't necessarily cheap because they have overheads and they, you know, they need to pay for the theatre and the rights and the costume and everything else.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but you have to, you kind of have to do broader brushstrokes, I think, where you just have to get people on and get people off. And it is just a case of going to B6, you know, and work your way around.
The grid.
Okay. I mean, it's, you know, but it does work, you know, it has to work. And that's how some directors work.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah. Okay. So I like that. All that said, I do like that you have a more organic approach to it. I don't know if I used that word or you did. I think I did. I think maybe we both
did. Yeah.
But I guess, how do you then begin to feed in other elements of it, which is like, you've got individual characters that you're talking to and developing stuff with. How are you then formulating kind of the relationships and character objectives with your vision in mind? So that makes sense, because I can see how you're allowing like the process of creating a blocking to unfold. You're discussing with characters, actors about their character. How much emphasis are you putting on your vision of, like, are you looking ahead to that specifically to make sure the characters are falling in line with kind of like an incremental developmental thing? Or are you, again, just allowing, making sure we've covered this scene and this scene and this scene, and then when we bring it together, we'll see how they buffer up against each other. Does that make sense? Again, that's another question.
It does, yeah. God, thanks for that really long question. No, it does make sense. And the answer is that everything is working to move towards the final, literally the final second.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, everything has a knock-on effect to everything else.
Right.
So it is a slow and gentle, or maybe a very, very quick, but everything is a build-up to that final moment, you know, and to what happens at the end, the payoff, if you like.
Yeah.
So, yes, when I'm working towards... So, for instance, we have the luxury of knowing what's happening at the end. In real life, you don't. But we have the luxury. So we know that that person is either going to die or be happy or... you know, open a cafe, you know, with their pet rabbit or whatever. And so you have that in mind when you start. So how does that person, and again, this is either as an actor or as a director or as a writer, you have to think, how does that person get from there to there? What has happened in that space? And that's the only answer I can give, really. Yes, I do. How we do that may differ,
right,
as a director, but as a writer, the big thing is everything that you do has to feed into the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. So every line has to have its place and earn its place there. And one of the massive, huge things about writing is taking them out, taking the lines out. So somebody likened it to, you know, a piece of marble and the statue is already in the marble. They just have to sculpt it out, really. They're just free in the, you know, I don't know if that's the way I work, but it definitely is. You know, I always know the end.
Right.
I always know what's happening, what's going to happen at the end. So then you have to sort of almost work backwards, really, and formulate, you know, how the characters get from there to there,
okay.
Which is really important.
Yeah. Okay, good. I would like to dedicate some time to the writing then, if that's possible. Yes.
At the moment, I finished the job that I was doing and I decided to go to university and study creative writing.
Yes.
And this is where I am now at the moment, as you know, I'm an actor writer.
Right.
Well, I always knew that I enjoy text and I enjoy reading and I enjoy reading plays.
Right.
I enjoyed reading plays as much as I enjoyed performing them, because you can sort of work it out in your head, can't you? Even if you just pick a play and read it, it's really important to do that, because you get a different perspective. And then when someone comes along and says, you know, hello, I'm the director and this is my vision, and you can say, oh, I never thought of it like that. So even though,
but also you can feed in to his, if the director, his or her,
allows
you to, you have a greater knowledge of what your vision of the whole play is, not just your part or just
you
your
can bring your vision with theirs, which is what it should be, collaborative.
Yeah, agree.
With the, you know, with the director and the actors and anybody else surrounding, you know, the musicians or anything like that. It's great. I mean, the word collaboration was just, I wasn't even in my vocabulary. I just, because I had this idea that when you write something or when you produce something, you it's yours and it's your ideas. And I had this idea that, well, if somebody says something to me about that, suddenly it's not my idea, it's their idea. Oh, and I have to share the glory. No, that's how it works. And I think it was like literally on my first day at the college, and John Ritalik said to me, you know, right, collaboration is important. Work together. And I was like, okay. And as soon as you get talking with someone and riffing and you go, okay, well, what about if the character did this? Well, even better, what if they, oh yes. And you work up. Sometimes the energy isn't there and the
skill
chemistry.
The skill is spotting that.
Yeah, exactly. But you can still get something from it. You get something from everything.
Yeah.
So my writing, it draws on all aspects. So my first job was shelling prawns in a factory. Okay. Yeah. With wellies and an overall and a cap, 6 months. Loads of characters have come from that. I've worked in shops, I've worked on an airline, I've worked in as a blue coat at Pontins, and you know, I've done lots of things, and at every turn there is someone, there are people, there are characters. And I, you know, the writers are often asked, who did you base that on? Well, it isn't one person. It's an amalgamation of lots of people. So that's what I find exciting about creating something from nothing, is the fact that you can, you know, literally build this world. And then once you've created this and you've refined it and you've spent 5 years writing something, because it takes a long time. It doesn't just come out of you, you know. And then when you put it out, then it has a different life all of its own.
Yeah.
And it's up to someone else. And yes, you can have I've been in situations where I haven't been asked to be in the rehearsal room. In fact, I've been asked not to be in the rehearsal room. And I've been in situations where I've been there every step of the way. And I sit there quite happily watching, you know, and I give my opinion if it's asked for.
Yeah.
But I think as a writer, I think experience is key, because it comes into everything.
Yeah.
Because if you've never seen a death, for instance, if you've never been with someone who died, yes, you can write it and you can research it and you can ask people what it's like, and you'll probably do a very good reproduction of it. But I think there's just that little element of when you've been with someone who's died, or when you've, you know, you've been married, or you've, you know, been divorced or anything else, I think you just bring something extra. So there's always something in my work about something I've lived.
Okay. How, the nitty-gritty of creating it then, what process do you go through? And again, I appreciate, this is for the people listening, that there's nothing implicitly different between, well, the writing of a play is the writing of a play, right? It's not amateur, it's not professional, it's not, I mean, ultimately, it's either or, but I'm, in terms of like the having an idea, putting it on paper and giving it to someone to perform, doesn't have to fit in any particular amateur, professional, whatever slot. So, but from my mind, in terms of talking about it, I'm really interested in someone listening, discovering how the creation of the play takes place, so that when, even as an amateur, when you're dissecting that information, you've got an idea of how someone like yourself has written it. Because, you know, I'm a big advocate of, you read that play and you begin to, as soon as you get given the, whatever script it is, you begin to dissect it and look at the characters and look at your character in relation to other characters and look at your character in relation to their objectives and your character in relation to the overarching story. So if you've got an idea of how that's created, that's really going to help you dissect all those little bits. I'm just kind of clarifying why I'm really keen to talk to you about it, because I think it does feed into an amateur's world.
Yes, and even though I am of a certain age, I am classed as early career because I graduated in 2019. Mm-hmm. So I am early career. I am still learning, and in fact, I'm taking part in an advanced writing workshop myself. So again, I'm, you know, there's lots to learn. There's lots I still don't know. For instance, you know, the chap I was on the masterclass with was saying that as a writer, you don't necessarily have to write everything in, because you can't say, you know, guy scratches his nose and then he picks up a cup and then he slurps and then he thinks. That would be ridiculous, because then nobody would, you know, would listen to it.
No, and it would be a thousand pages long as well.
Exactly. And so when I was at uni, there was an actress on my course, and she said, well, of course, you know, the actors don't listen to, don't look at the stage directions. They just basically, the director and the actors just ignore them. And I turned around and I gave her a Paddington Bear hard stare, and she looked at me. And then we had a chat afterwards, and I said, I do actually know what you mean, because it is up to the director to decide, you know, which part of the stage direction is a direction. It's not my job as a writer to figure out how to produce it. So anything is possible, and you know, it's an interpretation of whatever the writer has written. And people might look at that and go, well, how do you do that? No, you audience suspend their disbelief. That's a big thing about making theatre. So I wrote a short one-act play for the Oxford Theatre Guild, mm-hmm. And they put on in the festivals in 2016. And that had an open-ended ending. Mm-hmm. So basically, you know, the police knock at the door and it was like, oh, bloody hell. And, you know... People who saw it said, I want to know what happens. And I said, I'm really glad that you want to know what happens, because it means that you are engaged, interested and invested. And and, you know, it was great. And I could have made it so that, you know, because this is the piece that I'm working on turning into a full length musical. Which is brilliant, because it's about a singer in the 50s, in the late 50s, who has a lot of hurdles to overcome. And I could have written so that she either gets success or doesn't get success, but I wanted to stop it there, because again, there's something about, if you think of a cliffhanger at the end of, you know, sort of
a
six-part series, you know, you need a reason to carry on. Yeah. So yeah, I was really pleased when people were frustrated, because they were like, oh, you know, but... you do, at the end of the day, you do have to make a decision, mm-hmm. But things can take years.
When you said that you used, you were a character writer, so you used those experiences that you'd had and the people that you'd met throughout your life, how do you construct them? It might be an unanswerable question, because it just comes out of, you know, here's Bob, he worked in this factory. Okay, let's write down what Bob does in a manner that I can kind of put on a piece of paper. How does he interact with Jane? Well, are you looking at creating a set of characters that feed into what you think is the central idea? And therefore, you're just sort of cramming them together, and they're bouncing off each other, not working. There's a bit of friction. Okay, let's take that bit out. How does, again, because of the character nature of it, it feels like it's a nice to understand that. And from my perspective as a director, to understand how you've taken this character from your mind or from your experience and brought him to the page. When I'm reading it, I can then sort of think, oh, so this person lived somewhere and did this. It helps me with their backstory and stuff. Mm-hmm. What for you as the writer allows you to pick that person, that person, that person, and feed into this story?
So I have to know everything about them. Not everything about them, but I have to know as much as possible about all of the characters. And yeah. I know, even if none of it makes it to the page, mm-hmm. I think it's really important. And that's the same for actors and directors as well. I think if they explore that in the rehearsal, and you know, and they know that, you know, his dad left him when he was seven and that had a really big effect on him. If that affects like one or two lines in the play or a section of the play, we will know somehow, and there's always a way.
They won't know what it is, but it'll
exactly. There's always a way to convey it. So if there's a pause, even pauses are brilliant. Please, everyone, love the pauses. I'm like, don't rush it. Oh God, that pause needs to be, you know, and an audience loves it, and people are so afraid of them, and you know, they want to just get through. It's not about getting through it, you know, be in the moment. It's like what we all should be doing when we're living, and we don't really live in the moment. But it's, you know, if you've got people leaning forward to listen to what's happening, that's brilliant, and that's exactly what I want. I want people to be, you know, engaged. So all of the characters, they all have a basis. They all have I do a character, yes, I am that person. I do a character breakdown, mm-hmm. of who they are and what they are. And you know, not every single so there might be somebody mentioned, but yeah. I wouldn't
the butcher doesn't
know.
Need
yeah the butcher yeah exactly but so I do know who they are. And then the trick that I've learned, that I kind of figured out really, that you have to write everything. So write everything, okay. Especially in the first draft. So everything goes in. So if it's 1,000, you know, pages or whatever, and you have to get it down to, you know, 30 or 40 or whatever, then so be it. It has right. to be. So again, that's a big skill that I learned, is to whittle down. So write everything, write a 500 word story, and then write it again and make it 250 words, then 100, then 50. And then literally you can write the story. You can tell the story that people will, in a way that people will understand, in 10 words,
right.
which is massive. That's a massive skill, and it takes a long time, and right. I still haven't fully, you know, mastered it. So so I write the characters, and I know who they all are in relation to each other, and I will write the first draft, and everything will be in there, and everybody will be in there,
right.
and then eventually when you reread and you start to redraft, to bring out the human drama. So okay, it's always nice. About humanity, and it's always about real true stories and people. And so everybody, we all have the connection that we all live and breathe and we're on this earth, right? And then we're all important to ourselves, aren't we? We're important to other people, but at the end of the day, you know, you're still that baby who thinks the world revolves around them. And I just have to look at it and think, right, what would happen now? So famously, I don't know whether it was one of the producers. They needed something to happen in Coronation Street in the, I think it was the late 80s. And one of the producers said, right, who is the most well-loved and who is the most loved-up characters? You know, who is the most solid characters? And they said, Sally and Kevin. And right, split them up. And that was it, and they did. And it turned into this huge, gripping thing, and it was gripping, and people, you know, people hated it because they were like, no, what have you done? But they secretly loved it because they love to hate things, you know, and they love to hate people and characters. So that's basically what I think, you know. And, and another analogy, which is brilliant, was, you know, put your character up a tree and then throw rocks at them.
Nice.
Which I love, you know.
That's good.
So it's just all, you know, and it's not all about drama. And it could be little things. It could be like, you know, somebody, you know, who's developing MS, who is has enabled to make themselves a cup of tea, and it's their first inkling that something's not right. It could be that, or it could be somebody gets fired, or it could be somebody dies. But you know, it's always something has to move it and drive it forward.
No, I think that's very nice for a director listening. That if a writer like yourself is thinking about both the big dramatic things, the big emotional things, but also the small nuances of a character that feed into what's to come, it's important as a director to read that text and see those things, because portraying that moment where the teacup shakes just a little bit, and even if 50% of the audience spot that, it's integral.
Somebody will somewhere.
Yeah.
Always. Somebody has their eye on every part of the stage at any one time.
Yeah.
So if anybody comes out of it, so I've seen professional shows and it's dreadful when you see them come out of character, or they look up at the light, or they notice something off stage or whatever, and you're like, what the fuck? You've just literally taken me out of myself.
And
it's really annoying, isn't it?
Yeah.
So people have to be on it and in it all the time. And yes, they can, you know, sack off the stage directions or whatever. But as long as they get the intention.
Yeah.
Of what the writer meant, then that's important.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like the idea that you are feeding stuff in there. I mean, the stuff you mentioned, that it may not, when it happens in the script and on the stage, it may not be that the person watching goes, it may be afterwards, at the end.
It's a seed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, when they suddenly go, shit, in that act one, that bloody thing.
And not everybody remembers, and you know, you might have to go back and see the play again to, you know, or I've watched a series and gone, oh my God, so all of that happened. And well, look at Line of Duty, you know, build on, you know. And then like, you know, sometimes you have to just go back and watch and like say, oh God, I get it now. Look at that. How clever is that? But you didn't realize you were being, you know, it's like the whole thing about the gun. If you show a gun.
Yeah. You've got to use it at some point.
You've got to use it at some point by act three. So, you know, which is true.
Yeah.
And it's really nice again, as a writer, to, include little nuggets that people might recognize, or people might, traits that people might, like we were talking about earlier about people having little tics, you know, little vocal tics, for instance. And so they might say, you know, like somebody might say, type of thing, yes, type of thing. And you know that, and people recognise that, you know. Or if somebody said to me, a few years ago, oh, I see your husband does the annoying thing that my husband does. I said, what? Jangles his money in his pockets. I hadn't noticed it. Now,
never.
every day. So if you have a character who's literally just standing there and he's just got a little bit of nervous energy and he's just jangling his money or jangling his keys or, you know, whatever, and the person just doesn't even have to say anything, just literally turns and looks at them, and then the person just stops jangling their keys and says, sorry.